I know it seems like we've been at it for a long time, turn that on. But we're on the downhill slope. We've got this morning and Wednesday, and then Grant said he's going to drag out the last four chapters till the end of December so that we can start fresh in the new year. All right, Grant.
There's only two chapters left.
All November, all of December, right?
There's only going to be like the Israelites in the wilderness.
That was just uncalled for.
Anyway. Now that's today's class.
All right, back to chapter 46. Genesis chapter 46, we have Jacob's journey to Egypt. And we'll do a little reading here. But as we read it, maybe contemplate the thought that he's going to Egypt and his father was told not to go to Egypt. And we saw Abraham spend some time in Egypt. And there's a lot of interaction between in all of Genesis that concerns Egypt. And we'll talk some more about that. But I'm going to read in chapter 46 and then we'll go from there. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the vision of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here am I." And he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes." Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and his sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones and their wives, and the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. So they took their livestock and their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with them, his sons and his sons' sons, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel: Jacob, his sons who went to Egypt. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn. The sons of Reuben were Hanok, Palu, Harzon, and Carmi. The sons of Simeon were Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of the Canaanite woman. The sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The sons of Judah were Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah, but and Onan died in the land of Canaan. The sons of Perez were Harzon and Hamul. The sons of Issachar were Tola, Puva, Job, and Shimron. The sons of Zebulun were Shered, Elon, and Jehiel. These were the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Padanaram, and his daughter Dinah. All the persons, his sons, his daughters, were 33. The sons of Gad were Zephion, Haggai, Shunai, Esbon, Eri, Arodi, and Arli. And the sons of Asher were Jemna, Ishua, Isuai. I don't know. If y'all want to kick in there, you can. Beri and Sarah, their sister. And the sons of Berah were Heber and Michael. There were the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah, his daughter, and she bore to Jacob 16 persons. The sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, and Joseph and Benjamin. And to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. The sons of Benjamin were Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, Huffim, and Ard. These were the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob, 14 persons in all. The sons of Dan were Husham. The son of Dan was Husham. The son of Naphtali were Jezreel, Gunai, Jezir, and Shelem, and they were the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave Rachel, his daughter, and she bore these to Jacob, 7 persons in all. And all the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt, who came from his body, besides Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all, and the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2 persons. All the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were 70. Then he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen, and they came to the land of Goshen. So Joseph made ready his chariot and went to Goshen to meet his father Israel, and presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, because you are still alive." And Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, 'My brothers and those of my father's house who are in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. So it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, "What is your occupation?" that you shall say, "Your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth even till now, both we and our fathers, that we may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians." Okay, so we have Jacob going to Egypt. When we left off in our last study, Joseph had revealed himself to his brothers, and his brothers came back and reported that Joseph was alive and well, and that not only was he well, he was in authority over all Egypt. He was the governor of Egypt, and that he was requesting that his father and the whole family come. And what proof, I guess, did they bring that with them when they came back to their father to request his move to Egypt?
Joseph sent along a number of gifts to his father, and then he also had sent, as per Pharaoh's instruction, the wagons for the women, children, and Jacob to be transported on.
Yeah.
To
So Pharaoh had suggested the carts go, and then Joseph sent the carts, and then they mentioned the carts here again, and that they're going to ride back in the carts. And so this was a big thing. And Jacob is dumbfounded by the whole situation when he finds out Joseph is living. And back up in verse 26 of chapter 45 says, "When they told him, saying, 'Joseph is still alive, and he is the governor over all the land of Egypt,' and Jacob's heart stood still because he did not believe them. But then when he saw the carts," in verse 27, "that Joseph sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob, their father, revived." It was almost like he had a heart attack or something. But then in verse 28, "Then Joseph said, 'It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.'" He wasn't on his deathbed. You know, it kind of makes it sound like he was on his deathbed. Judah had mentioned to Joseph before that if we tell him Benjamin's not coming back, it'll kill him for sure. So maybe he was ailing in health, but he lived 17 more years in Egypt. And so it wasn't like he was, you know, imminently fixing to die. But he has had a long life, and we're going to read that in chapter 47 when he's recounting his years and age to Pharaoh. He tells him how old he is and that he's not as old as his fathers were and that kind of thing. And so he's an old man, and his sons are older than you would think. You know, some of the pictures and the characters you see in some of the artwork kind of makes them all look like they're anywhere from 20 to 50 years old. But I think some of these guys were probably 70 or 80 years old, just by the, you know, some of the older ones, by the way that they, you know, Judah was a grandfather, had grandchildren by the time, because we know of his sons that had died there in Canaan. And so just those stories and putting pieces together, you realize that the family is a lot older than you would think, at least that generation is. So he comes there. Jacob is in his 40s, right? Early 40s at this point. And Joseph is. And so he comes there and greets his son. But Jacob picks up and does what God tells him. What did God tell him? There in the first couple verses we read. Go to Egypt. And so he says, "I'm going to take you there, and I'm going to go with you, and then I'm going to bring you back again. Did Jacob ever actually come back himself? Oh, that's a trick question, isn't it? His nation came back. That's right. And we'll notice in the next few chapters that Jacob and Israel are used interchangeably a whole lot. And in some other scriptures in Exodus, you'll see that interchange. And if you're studying the Psalms, some of the Psalms that refer to Jacob and Israel, they'll just use them interchangeably in the same sentence. You know, that the pride of Jacob and the joy of Israel, and it'll just say that in the middle. So, Jacob never goes and sees Canaan again himself. Which God doesn't tell him that he's going to see it. He just says, I'm going to go down with you. Don't fear. And this is the plan, and that I'm going to come back with you. And so he picks up and goes. Interestingly enough, when we study in Hebrews 11 and you have that list of the faithfulness, and we've talked about this quite a bit, do you remember what is attributed to Jacob's, his faith, the example of Jacob's faith, what is mentioned there? It's not this. It says by faith he blessed Joseph's sons, right? And so he goes to Egypt. He blesses Joseph's sons, who were in effect Egyptians. They were born and raised there. Their mother was Egyptian. Their grandparents were Egyptian, and Joseph had become an Egyptian. But he goes there and he attributes his faith to that. But there are things like this where in verse 3 and 4, he says, you go down and I'll go with you and you'll come back here. And Jacob does exactly what he's told to do. And he does that by faith. And so just because we're not given a list of all the things that he did like we are of Abraham, there's so many different things mentioned in Hebrews about the faith of Abraham there in different events. And it's very limited on Jacob. You see some of these unquestioning acts of faith that he does and puts himself into, and he just automatically does it. When God speaks to him in verse 4, I will go down with Egypt and surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hands on your eyes. He affirms that Joseph is alive. He's going to see him. And in verse 5, then Jacob arose from Beersheba and the sons of Israel and carried their father Jacob. So he didn't question it anymore at all. And in verse 28 of the last chapter, we see that he believes. He said, it is enough. In other words, I believe you. It's real. Those are the carts from Egypt. You say he's alive, and then God affirms that to him. When he goes, what all does he take with him? Everything. Take 70 people, and I think there's really, it says 70, but it also mentions Joseph and his sons who were born in Egypt as part of that number, but there were 66 that go, and that doesn't mention any servants or workers or, you know, household type people. Yeah, so there had to have been more than the 66. These are the, it says these are from his body, so this was the bloodline, I guess you would say. Yes, ma'am. For the 400 years, yeah.
Right, your family's going to be in land not theirs, and I'm going to bring them out. So, you know, I was thinking about that as I was reading over this and tied it back in.
Okay, so did I. That's pretty good. Just so y'all know, Rose has put together a book thicker than my Bible electronically, and she keeps sending it to us every week. And telling us that she's almost done, and she keeps skipping the chapters that I have to teach. So, like, chapter 48, which is in my group this for Wednesday. Well, you have till Wednesday to get all my notes done for me. Anyway, I think she just wants to see what I'll come up with, and then she goes back and puts it in there. So he goes down to Egypt. He takes all of his livestock and his animals and everything that can fit in these carts. What was it that Pharaoh told Joseph before about bringing them there? You remember that discussion when he said, they've come to you, bring them here? Don't bring anything with you. You'll be prepared for. So he says, just go back. And when Pharaoh, when he's weeping and he's talking to his brothers, and then Pharaoh gets in the conversation about it, he says, yeah, go get them and bring them here, and don't bring anything with them. They still bring their animals and their livestock. And with that, jumping ahead a little bit, when they come back with all these animals, they were an abomination to the Egyptians because they were shepherds. And so Joseph gives some instruction to his brothers and his father about their work and occupation. What was it? Do what? Yeah,
so that way they could dwell separately from the Egyptians.
Yeah, I think that he does tell them that they're shepherds and have been for generations, and that's what they do. He didn't try and hide it, but he was telling them, I think, to be forthright about it. And then he's like, I've got a plan, and we've already talked about it, and you're going to dwell up here. And so he sends them to Goshen, and I think it's by the authority of Pharaoh that he sends them to Goshen. But then he goes ahead and gets them placed there. Then he says, we're going to go down and talk to Pharaoh and say, I've got him there, and get his blessing on it. And he's going to ask you what you do for a living. Interestingly enough, when they get to Pharaoh, when jumping ahead, we didn't read this just now, but y'all know it. What did Pharaoh request of them? Of his flocks and cattle and whatever he had, right? So their reputation and maybe it was well-founded, maybe it wasn't, but I think Pharaoh's making the assumption that since Joseph is so capable and has got the Lord on his side, and he is a manager of managers, that his family is probably all the same kind of people, and that they came from these shepherd background. So he says, pick somebody from among your family that's capable of managing these flocks of mine and dealing with our issues. And so that was part of that extension. So Pharaoh is really extending a tremendous amount of favor towards Joseph in a big way. I mean, it wasn't just, yeah, one of your brothers can come live with you and y'all can dwell together. This was, I'm bringing your whole family down. But they weren't really a nation, so it wasn't like he was moving a country, and he was just moving Joseph's family, and it was a big family, but it wasn't overwhelming to him. Yes, sir. You know, I was thinking a little bit about the shepherding thing being an abomination, because it doesn't say that the Hebrews were an abomination to the Egyptians because they were shepherds. It just says shepherds are. And I was thinking, is it really talking about the way we use the word abomination, or they're like second-class citizens, you know? And so the Egyptians are going to see y'all as second-class citizens. I mean, Egyptians historically had some pretty odd, you know, it's like body hair. They wanted to get rid of every kind of body hair, and then they put a wig on, or a thing that, you know, a helmet or a hat that looked like a wig, you know, and they had all these very interesting things in their culture that they did. And so I kind of wonder if when they use the word abomination here, if it's not more of a, you know, they're third-rate citizens, you know, because that's what they do. Because it's a necessary evil. You had to eat something. They weren't all vegetarians, you know. So then they had animals. Obviously, Pharaoh had flocks that he had, but he needed managers for them. So, and we're going to see here in another chapter or two that when the famine continues on, what does all the people bring to buy food with? They're trading their animals in to get grain, right? So every person in the whole country had animals. They were all herders in some fashion or another. Maybe it was just a couple or three, but it was, they all had animals. So it's kind of hard to believe that they were considered anybody and everybody across the country, you know, an abomination. Otherwise, nobody would be able to get along. Did you have something, Gary? Yeah, it seems like the ground was better at Goshen, because they're two or three years now into the famine, and when he's warning his brothers when he reveals himself, he said, "We're in there, and God put me here to preserve you." He mentions that they were a couple years into the famine already, and there was several years to go, and yet when he's talking to Pharaoh and Pharaoh's talking to them, he says, "You have all the land of Goshen before you; it's the best of our land." And then Moses says, in there is a commentary that it's the land of the Ramses, and so we know a little bit historically about them. So this was the best of the best land in Egypt as far as herds and stuff would go. Yeah. Better, yeah.
To be somewhat greener than it is throughout other parts of Egypt. So, you know, I think that's where I can go on with my animals.
That's right.
Especially in a period of famine, because, you know, there's still water there and plants can still grow.
Larry, do you have something? Oh, okay. All right, so they take all their animals there. And then Joseph tells them that, you know, y'all are shepherds. Don't hide the fact of that. Be truthful about it. I'm going to basically go up and meet with Pharaoh and let him know that y'all are here. So he gets, Judah goes ahead and finds the place that they're going to move. They all move there together. And before they really get settled in, Joseph goes up to meet him. What is Joseph's interaction with his father when he meets him up there? For extended period of time, he embraces him. So they haven't seen each other, and he was how old when he went in captivity? 17, I think it was, or at least he was 17. Yeah, when he was reporting on his brother. So he was 17 or 18 when he went in captivity, and now he's in his early 40s. So he's been separated for 20 plus years. A lot of time has gone by. But now he sees him with his own eyes and spends a few minutes with him, but then gets right back to business. does anybody have any other thoughts or comments about what we've read there? Yes, sir. Well, most definitely. I think so. Yeah, he references himself, like he said, as a father. But I don't know about the age gap there, or how old Pharaoh was, if that was a literal thought, or if it was just that he was a senior advisor type. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What you don't see here is you don't see Joseph moving in with his family to Goshen. You know, Joseph apparently stays somewhere else, and then he goes right back to work. He's still the governor of the land. It's not just because his family came to Egypt doesn't mean that he's set his job aside and becomes a Hebrew in the same way again. So he has that connection, but he's still in and among, because as we get into chapter 47, and I'm not sure if there's any switch around the timeline. I think it's picking back up on the fact that we're still in the famine. But in chapter 47, we see the year is continuing on, and the devastation that it's bringing, and the people of Egypt coming to him, you know, asking for help. And earlier we saw when they came to Pharaoh and said, "Hey, we're hungry and this is going south," they said, "Well, there's Joseph. He's the one who came up with this plan. Go talk to him." Now we don't see Pharaoh in the conversation at all here. We see Joseph taking control of the situation, or continuing to take control of it, and then building wealth for Pharaoh and consolidating power, really, ultimately, in Pharaoh, with owning all the land and all the resources and the people of Egypt. And so I guess I'm speaking about 47. We didn't read it, but Joseph goes back to work is what I'm saying. And so his family goes and does their thing. They settle into Goshen, and then he prepares for him and takes care of him, but ultimately he has to go back to work and do his job. When he talked to his brothers, back in chapter 45, verse 5, after he revealed to him, he says, But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. And so his outlook on the whole entire situation was, and because of the dreams, and because of the dreams even at 17, 18 years old, he had put all that together. God had given him the knowledge of the situation, and he says, don't be upset. Yeah, you did a bad thing, but don't be grieved with yourself or be angry with yourself. Let's move on past this, because God put me here for a reason, to preserve him. And his job wasn't done. And so here in chapter 46, he's moving his family. He's preserving their life. In 47, he goes back to work to continue that work until it's all done. And so then that's the last we hear about the famine, is about verse 26 of chapter 47. All of the people are paying one-fifth of everything that they make on Pharaoh's land that he's now acquired because of Joseph. They're paying a tribute, basically, or a portion, 20% of everything that they're getting is going to him as a tax, and they're keeping the rest. And so Joseph is completely committed to the job at hand that he's doing. It's not sidetracked from it. Talking about that preservation, or that idea of it. So in 46, verse 3, God tells Jacob to go to Egypt. He doesn't say, go to Egypt because I'm going to preserve you there. But he says, go there and then I'll bring you back up. But this is what I want you to do. That I just read in chapter 45, Joseph says, God did this to preserve us. And so even though they may not have seen the really big picture that we've been talking about through our course of Genesis, where God is taking care of his people, and he's making sure that they're provided for, and then he sends them to Egypt. And as Rose mentioned in chapter 15, the dream that Abraham had, and where all of his people, well, there was a really weird dream there in chapter 15. But anyway, through a dream in the night, God says, your descendants are going to go to a nation for 400 years, and they're going to be cruel and difficult to them, and then I'll bring them out of that situation. And then he says in that same chapter that he's going to punish that nation that does that to them. Well, what nation are we talking about? We're talking about Egypt. So this is the beginning of that situation that we're starting to unfold. And so as you study into Exodus, we see that 400 years of time that the people are spent there, or we really kind of pick up at the end of that 400 years. So in between Genesis and Exodus is the time period that they're there. But they're in Egypt, but Egypt is a good place right now, and God's using this good place to protect his people and let them incubate and become a nation, because basically they have 70 people to show for it. When they come out, they have a couple million people, and so in 400 years, they're a huge nation. Another thing about that preservation part of it, let's turn over to Exodus real quick. I want to look at some Exodus chapter 15. In Exodus 15, they've just crossed the river, across the Red Sea. And, if you remember, in chapter 14, verse 24, it says that it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down on the army of Egypt. This is while they're crossing the middle of the Red Sea. Through the pillar and the fire and the cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians, and he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." So now they're trying, the people of Israel have just crossed the Red Sea. They're on the other side. The Egyptians are out in the midst of the sea. And the Lord says he took their wheels off of the of their chariots. Okay, it wasn't like they were, if you've ever watched one of the old movies of them, they're just steaming ahead full blown, and then all of a sudden the water claps on them. This says he troubled them and took their wheels off, and now they're driving them with difficulty. They got a flat tire in the middle of the river with a 1,000 foot of water above them, right? So then it says that he collapsed the water on top of them, and they all died. In chapter 15, you have the Song of Moses. If you go to verse 14 of chapter 15, the people will hear and be afraid. Sorrow will take hold of the inhabitants of Philistia. The chiefs of Edom will be dismayed. The mighty men of Moab, trembling, will take hold of them. All the inhabitants of Canaan will melt away. Fear and dread will fall on them by the greatness of your arm. They will be as still as a stone till your people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over whom you have purchased. You will bring in and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, in the place, O Lord, which you have made for you, for your own dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, watch which your hands have established. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. So by taking Israel's family and preserving them in Egypt and allowing them to become a great nation, then he takes them out of Egypt as a nation, but not a nation with a land, and he takes them out of Egypt. They leave with all kinds of possessions. Then he destroys the whole entire army of Pharaoh and Pharaoh all in the sea at one time. Moses says, look what everybody in front of us is going to think. The most powerful country in the world was just taken down by our God while we're preserved as this little small fledgling nation with no land. And the Philistines, the first ones we're going to get to, and they're going to be trembling with fear. And then the people of Moab and all the rest of them, they're all going to be trembling. And so he sings this song and to encourage the people of Israel to keep going, that God's with them. But at the same time, look at the perspective from the people of Canaan. Why was it that God didn't allow them to stay in Canaan? He took them to Egypt. One of the reasons he took them out of Canaan and did not leave them there. Look in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 16. You know, sometimes we get hung up on just the people of Israel and their pursuits, but there was other nations in the world that God was concerned about. In chapter 15 and verse 16, when he was talking to Abraham, he says, "But in the fourth generation they will return here," that is Canaan, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." God took them out of the Canaan, of developing as a nation in Canaan and fighting with all these people, because those countries still had a chance to be righteous and there were still God-fearing people among them, but they were going the wrong way. He takes them to Egypt to protect them and to let them grow up. But Egypt was a good place for now, but they were going to be judged. He says, "But I'm going to judge that land which will bring affliction on my people." So he judges Egypt later. Then he brings Israel over there as a nation to judge the Canaanites and to push them out. And so God was being long-suffering with all these nations and allowing them to pursue righteousness, which they didn't do. And then he uses Israel to judge them. And I just think as we look at the whole picture and the interaction of the children of Israel and of, even with Abraham, these promises that are made, you have to remember those other people in the world that that God was also trying to preserve. Yes, ma'am.
And I think that's why it was important for them to go to Goshen, because that kind of took them out of the mainstream of Egyptian life in the other cities that had developed along the Nile to the south, by them being up in the northern part, by them being shepherds and people that took care of herds and flocks. You know, they were kept separate. That separated them from the Egyptian norm, and I think well. And God was using that to keep them separate from the Egyptians.
That's right. You know, we're about out of time, but as another side note, talking about them being separate, we see in a few hundred years they're all slaves of Pharaoh and of Egypt, and the winds change, and nobody's looking favorably toward the Hebrews anymore, and they're calling them Hebrews at that point. And there's something else, a little tidbit in here in chapter. Let me get back over there. I've turned in chapter 47 where Joseph made it a law, and they started taking, or verse 25 of chapter 47, it says, "So they said, 'You have saved our lives, let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants.'" Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh would have one-fifth except the land of the priest only. And so they became his servant, Pharaoh's servants. I don't know that I would interject slaves here, but they became indentured, I guess, to Pharaoh permanently. The whole nation did, is what it paints the picture, because it only excludes the priest of Egypt. So you not only have this children of Israel that come in that are now under the rule of Pharaoh and his nation in Goshen, but you have the entire nation of the Egyptians that are now under not just a king, but they're indentured to the king in a different way, a different level, because there's some kind of a power shift here between the people having their own authorities to come and go. They weren't paying this kind of a tax. This wasn't levied before, and the land belonged to them as individuals. And then all of a sudden, Pharaoh saves all their lives by the hand of Joseph, and so now they're all his servants and serve him forever. So it solidifies, or not solidifies, but it puts all the power, presses all the power into one person in the nation, which we see that kind of power and control on display when we're talking about Moses going before Pharaoh and Pharaoh having control over the whole nation. Just you get that sentiment that Pharaoh has absolute control over everything, like a dictator, you know, whereas you don't really see that here. He's just the leader of this nation. And I think there's kind of a paradigm shift right here in these verses where Joseph establishes that. And so as a point of history, you know, when you study Egyptian history, even in the secular side of history, you see some of these things play out, even if they don't reference the Bible at all in their recount of it. You see these kinds of shifts in Egyptian culture and Egyptian ways of life and the control of the government and all those kind of things. And Moses is kind of giving us a recount, a historical, perfect account of how all this played out and how it came about. Interestingly enough, where did Moses grow up at? In Egypt. So this record, and I was just thinking about that this morning, the record that Moses had of this, he was a high up in Egypt too himself several hundred years later. I would say Joseph's name and the saving of Egypt through the worst famine and consolidating all the power and all the money into one place was probably, you know, pretty famed, and it was part of their well-known history, and so Joseph and Moses' lives in the same country overlapped a tremendous amount. So this was what you might say first-hand knowledge. I mean, he was removed from it, but he would have known this from the historians of Egypt himself personally because of his own education and growing up there in the midst of it. Any other comments or thoughts before we close? All right, Wednesday night we will read 47 and 48 and pick up where we left off. Thank you.